Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or seeking to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and Psych Reg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as clinical psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall. Welcome back. Richard, we just finished a wonderful conversation with a new friend, colleague from the UK, Dr. Robin Hadley.
What a wonderful way to start the day.
Yes.
This guy is a real treasure.
Yeah. So Dr. Robin Hadley is a counselor over in England.
In England, right.
Manchester, specifically.
We know about Manchester.
A little bit. There's a couple of soccer, football teams in Manchester, but he has a PhD in social gerontology.
Right.
Two master's degrees.
Yeah.
A master's in arts and a master's of science.
Right.
From the University of Manchester.
Mm-hmm. And all focusing on the same topic.
Yeah.
You know, he's become a real specialist.
Yeah. So his area of interest, most specifically, is sort of the fatherlessness,
mm-hmm.
Especially the role of involuntary
right.
fatherlessness, and how that relates to social issues, how it relates to psychological issues, and relationship issues.
Right. We often talk about the clock ticking in terms of women.
Right.
He has introduced, laid bare, opened up a whole area of research that, as he discusses, a whole area of research that's been ignored over the years. And we typically don't think of the effects of being childless on fathers. We always think of it in terms of mothers.
Right.
One of the questions I wanted to ask him was this concept of the old maid.
Right.
Is there anything comparable in men? No.
Yeah.
We don't.
Yeah.
I mean, here's the old maid, common. I mean, everybody knows the old maid, the old schoolmarm kind of stereotype. But he has developed an entire area of research about fatherless men, childless
right.
men.
Yeah.
Not fathers, childless men. And it's a fascinating area of research.
Yeah, yeah.
And great work.
Interesting how he you know, introduced this idea because he recognized something within himself. And that,
right.
that part of the story is fascinating.
That's the one. That's
you
the,
know, in his mid-30s, he realized that you know, he had this what he called broodiness
right.
that was happening, and he knew exactly what it was from,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty insightful.
Yeah, and I had my first child. You were in your 20s when you had children.
Correct.
I was in my 30s, and it was, and he reached that at about the same time, this idea. And I liked his term, broodiness, and he knew what it was.
Right.
And so he switched careers.
Yeah.
And
he's done a lot of different things.
Yeah. He's a wonderful I'd love to sit down and have dinner with him. Sometime.
Yeah, yeah. We'll make a trip over to Manchester.
Yeah.
But so links to his website and to his Twitter account are in the show notes. Definitely follow this guy. He's doing lots of stuff. Very, very interesting and very engaging. You will certainly enjoy this conversation. There's a few times where we have hard breaks in the interview just because. You know, he's living life, and so he had to take the dog out one time, and he had a package delivered.
He had a package delivered. That was great. He doesn't have a package delivered.
Which was fantastic.
Well, he had warned us, you know, that they might be delivering it about that day. It was, I guess, around noon.
Yeah, noon there.
In England. Yeah. And sure enough, there it was. The guy delivered the package. So there will be a couple of breaks,
we'll have a couple of breaks
in the narrative. But go ahead and take a look at this one. Fascinating guy. Wonderful guy. Nice, friendly, very friendly demeanor.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So, all right. So we hope that you enjoyed. If you have questions or if you, we're planning to talk to him again. So if you listen to this and you have any specific questions, send them to us and we'll be happy to add them to our list of questions, our growing list of questions for him
the next time
we talk to him.
Right.
Or you can just ask him directly through Twitter or however. So,
right.
All right. So enjoy the interview. Good morning.
Hey. Good morning.
Hey, Roger.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Yeah.
Well, fantastic. So I'm glad that the technology is working out well.
Yeah. Yeah. Cool.
Well, fantastic. Well, So it's about noon there, right?
Yeah, I'm looking for the clock. Yes,
just 10 past. Well, perfect. Well, we really appreciate you joining us. And yes, if there's a little bit of an interruption, that'll be fine. I can edit around all of that without any problem. So,
cool.
Well, very good. So we've been reading some of your work. You've done a lot of stuff.
I have, haven't I? Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know, and as I was reading it, I was, you know, as I kind of suggested, I was going to ask you right off, how did you get into that? This area, how did you get into this area of study?
Fortuitously, I guess. Yeah. I was a scientific and technical photographer for 30 years, and digital technology came through, and they didn't want to invest in that, so I took redundancy, and I wanted a change in career, so I looked at counselling, so I started training as a counsellor, and did a postgraduate diploma, and then there was a master's element to that, and for the dissertation for the master's, because it was counselling, it had to be something you'd experienced, and I just said to my supervisor, well, you know, I was very broody in my 30s, and she went, well, I've never heard anything about that, do that, and that's when I found out there was really nothing about men and desire for fatherhood, and that seemed very strange to me, considering when you drive down to it, there's two cells in the egg and the sperm, and all the research, or most of it, was around the egg, and that's biologically, but also sociologically as well, and psychologically, you know, what's all that about? And there's an absence there, so we're sort of missing 50% of that research question or that area, And that's what spurred me on. I'm not a natural academic. I come from a working class background, so it's all a bit scary going into university even now.
I can completely relate with that. You know, when I first went to the university from the small town that I'm from, it was quite a culture shift.
Yeah.
Hey, Roger, wait a minute. You have to slow down. Because I read... No, you don't have to slow down. When I started reading your work, I was absolutely astonished. I thought, wait a minute, where did all this come from? So now when you say, because it's fascinating, it's absolutely fascinating, and I agree with you, everything I've ever read is about women. It's about the egg. When you said to your advisor you were broody in your 30s, what were you saying? What were you telling her?
I was telling her that I had a feeling inside
Robin.
That I wanted to be a father,
Roger.
But also I had a sense of being out of step with where I should be.
Now, were you a father then?
Or I wasn't a father. I'm not a father now.
And you're not now, right?
No.
Yeah. Okay. So so you knew where the broodiness was coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So you knew why you were broody.
And I think it was, I believe there is a biological urge in men.
Yes.
It's really been investigated to that degree.
Right.
Well, whereas it has with women, it's sort of well established as part of the cycle for women. And I think the biggest thing though was my peers and colleagues becoming fathers.
Right.
And that sensation of I'm off track here. And people are on track. In fact, one of my colleagues that I actually knew from school, we just ended up working in the same place, he became a father. And I was so jealous. I was really so jealous of him. But being British, I couldn't express that. I just had to say, congratulations, sir. Well done. Let's move on.
Yeah, you're British and you're a man, so you couldn't express any of those emotions.
It's a quadruple whammy.
Right.
But our relationship was affected, and actually we had a chat about it over a cup of tea. He said, you know, something's not right between us now, that used to be.
Oh.
And I said, well, you're everything that I should be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's what the feeling, and a very key word there is should, of course, what I should be. So that really relates back to how I was brought up, what my beliefs were, and where I saw myself in relation to my life trajectory.
Now, I'm sure we're going to get into this as we go along, and I didn't mean to change your name in the process.
Okay.
But so I apologize for that. But you talk about a biological urge, but there's also this cultural overlay, right? The social. There's the, at one point you talk about the personal and the social.
Yeah.
By personal, do you mean biological?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So we have that urge.
Yeah.
And just part of our species, the will to, okay. Go back to Darwin, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Darwin was also very about the sociological aspect.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Very strong there on that. It wasn't all just biological. Why are we the species we are? It's the sociological aspect that's really made the difference to our evolution.
Yeah.
Sociological species tend to have bigger brains, tend to do better.
Right, right. So there's so many pieces of this that come together. The biological, evolutionary to some extent, the social, and you know, certainly I again in reading some of your work, one of my favorite classes, I actually ended up doing a minor in anthropology, and so the study of, you know, sort of these social cultural manifestations in different areas, and you know, as a species, typically we have such a patriarchal history, and you know, certainly the men have always been seen to be the person who goes out and leaves the family and goes and does their things, and the women stay home, and you know, certainly there's this root of from a long history where women are primarily associated with children. And there has been a significant shift over the past few decades where, you know, dads are now in delivery rooms when the babies are being born, and dads are going to, I was just talking to a patient the other day, and they had a baby shower, and she referred to it as a co-ed baby shower because now the men were invited to it. So do you see this as a shift socially in our culture, I guess?
It's definitely a shift in some cultures, but I guess there's a kickback in other cultures against that.
Okay.
And cultures shift and change and ebb and flow. But I think in Western culture, you've got to be careful about what you say, because I say Western and somebody will be thinking, oh no, you can't say Western, it's so defining. But as a broad concept,
sure,
everything's broad for people who want to argue about those points. But if you argue about every point, we're going to go on forever. But yeah, I think in Western culture there has been a shift in that way, and I think that's probably down to feminism's and the feminist movement in the 60s and 70s coming out. But
yeah.
I did read a paper actually from an obstetrician way back in the 70s. I sort of taken a sociological perspective of the maternity ward, saying, why aren't fathers allowed in?
Wow. From the 70s.
A bar against fathers really going to, even to visit.
Yeah.
In that time of birth and sort of thing. So it wasn't just men not wanting to go in. That was structured as well into the culture of the time.
Right.
So there's been changes at many deep levels. Excuse me, I think somebody's at the door.
Okay.
So,
all right.
Not barking as well.
Okay, so Robin.
Yeah, let's go back.
So you were talking about...
Well, we were talking about the... just that shift in cultures and
right.
and or social norms, and you
yeah.
had mentioned that paper from the 70s which is really interesting, because that was, you know, really at the at the height of, well, I don't know if it was at the height, but it's really what you associate when you look at whether it's older movies or documentaries that, and they talking about, you know, births and hospitals and things like that. The dad is always in the waiting room, you know, handing out cigars and all that kind of stuff. And it was, that's interesting that an obstetrician wrote about that in the 70s.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know what the experience in the UK is, but my mother delivered her last child in the 60s, in 1962 or 1963. She has no recollection of it. She said when she delivered her baby, she was wheeled into the room, she was put asleep, and when she woke up, there was a baby there.
Yeah.
So even the mother wasn't pregnant. When I first talked to my mother about we're dilated or we're effaced, she said, I have no idea what you're talking about. And she had delivered six children. And she had no idea because she said we were not, she said she wasn't there. She said we were put to sleep and when we woke up, there was a baby.
Wow.
Yeah.
So why should the dad be there?
Yeah.
Right? So it wasn't, so even the mom wasn't there.
Right.
As at least in 1962.
Wow.
So by 1981, I was in the delivery room.
Yeah.
With my first. But that was fairly recent. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I come from a big family as well. I'm one of eight.
Was it the same thing there in the UK? That
I think it probably was. Certainly, I can't recollect my mother actually saying anything about the birth experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my mother had no idea what it was. She had no idea about any of this.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was born at home, though. So there was this thing about in the UK of birth at home.
Did you have a midwife?
Luckily, a midwife was present because I wasn't breathing. And she got me breathing and I had oxygen. I was born in 1960. And that was, the NHS was in progress
right.
then.
Wow.
So, in a way, that was free, and that was a standard service.
Right, right.
Before the war, it wouldn't have been.
Yeah, right.
Or actually during the war as well.
Well, please express our gratitude to the midwife, because we're enjoying your work.
Oh, yes, yeah. Yeah, cool. But yeah, there is something about medicine being imposed on people.
Yeah.
And people in a process. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's, you've got to, you care about looking back with today's eyes on the past. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Well, what did they have?
Exactly.
Quality-wise, what were their goals? One of them would be to stop the horrendous mortality of babies and mothers.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, it was pretty, challenging before. And, I kind of thinking about to something that we were talking about a few minutes ago. Yeah, I think that we all have this, or I think most people, many people, have this sort of innate drive to be a parent. And mm-hmm. we want to be involved in the process. And I think that shift, because I have memories of my cousins being born. And I remember everybody in the waiting room the dads being in the waiting room. Mm-hmm. Nobody still went back and the wheeled mom out in the wheelchair with holding the baby. And, you know, the fascinating part of that it was the emotions were so different at that time, like as compared to when we had our kids, my wife and I had our kids. The emotions for everybody were different, and I wonder if part of it is maybe this social cultural thing towards sort of permitting men to be a little bit more emotional than they did in the past, because I agree with a lot of that you've done, Robin, that you know there's this drive, but where we have never really been allowed to talk about it, you know, the we don't really talk about how much dads want to be, or men want to be dads, or men's roles as dads outside of sort of being the disciplinarian and sort of putting the foot down, that type of thing. And maybe part of it is this permission that we have now to be a little bit more emotional.
Yeah. And it's such a rich and complex and fascinating area. And men are, I find, and that's quite a surprise for me to say that, but I think men are fascinating. And I think one of the things is, what narratives are available for men?
Mm-hmm.
within society, and we're conditioned, I think, from, well, depending when you were born, for me in 1960, was as a working class man, I was going to go to school, leave school, get a job. Because of the economic turn in the 70s, my parents were very keen for me to get a secure job in a bank or the civil service, something with a good pension, which were wise words that are coming through now. And then get married and have children. And my role then would be to be provider.
Right, right.
And that was very early on. I remember my parents saying, I wanted to do something when I was 12 or 13, and they said, no, you can't do that. And I was kicking off a bit and went, well, when you're a parent, you're going to have to make these decisions. And yeah. This is what we've got to do, is to say no to you now. But that assumption was there, that I would be a parent. And all the narratives are around being that.
Right.
What are the cultural narratives about not being a parent? Mm-hmm. For a man, there's some more around about women, but there's quite a variety in that. If you don't become a mother, sometimes you're looked down on,
yeah.
You're selfish, your career, or you're pitted. Mm-hmm. That's a shame about a mother. And some people choose to be parents, and some people choose not to be parents. And some people are parents who don't want to be parents. So it's a mixed up world on that.
Right.
But then, I think, certainly for most men, I think all over, there's a drive for you to be a father. And sometimes that's overt and very cultural aware. So there's a paper that's called You Are Not a Man Unless You Are a Father. And that's based on a small community, rural community in Africa, and that's interviewing men who are infertile and how they were treated. So if there was a village meeting and they raised the point, you're not a father, you don't count. That's quite overt. But I think in Western society that still comes through. One of the guys I interviewed was a health professional in child care. And they were talking about a case, and one of the other health professionals says, but you're not a parent, how can you say?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, different situation, same sort of underlying communication. So I think there's something around about what cultural narratives are there, and that's one of the things I'm trying to do in my research. It's not really answer questions, in a way, but actually just say, look, there's other options here. And that for men, it's all right to be broody and upset, because you know what's the thing for carrying on? Why are we alive existentially? And children are a great existential driver.
Right.
One of the guys I interviewed for my PhD said, you know, when I die, what am I going to pass on? I've got things from my grandparents and their grandparents. Where are they going to go?
Right.
But also, what have I got to live for? So another guy was his wife's niece had a baby, and he was a surrogate grandfather. And once that pregnancy was announced, he said, you know, I want to be grandfather this, because the biological grandfather wasn't around, died. And so he broached it with the niece and said, can I be surrogate grandfather? And a few hours after baby's born, gets a phone call, goes to the hospital, holds the baby, and he'd been rude. He wanted to be a dad and was infertile, so couldn't be one. And at that time, I really understood the bond between a parent and a baby. It was there. And that was something that I hadn't realized, although I had a feeling I wanted to be a father, I had the thoughts I wanted to be a father, but actually holding the baby, this is something I would do anything for. That realization at that moment, there was a deep connection.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes me think of, you know, I think it was Erik Erikson's stages of psychosocial development, where he talks about, you know, as we you know, reach a certain developmental stage in adulthood, you know, one of the things we do is we look to see what we're leaving behind, you know, what our history is, that generativity. And it sounds like a lot of what you're talking about is sort of related to that.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. With Erikson's stages, it's very much the adult ones are to do with reproduction.
Right.
Absolutely. A model, it really is a critical one. I can't remember which one, but it's actually, and you'll become a parent, and then these other things come in.
Mm. Right.
And Erikson died, didn't he? And then his wife put a 9 stage in about aging and becoming old.
Right.
Which was something like decline and frailty.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I guess the thing for me on the aging thing, in the UK, and I guess it's probably something similar in the US, a lot of care for older people is based on informal contact with the family. So adult children negotiate with care providers, residential places, on their care of their parents.
Right.
If you have adult children, what happens to you? Research would seem to indicate you get taken into formal care earlier than equivalent people with children, and for lesser conditions, stay there longer and are sent out later.
Right.
And that's really interesting on the social network, but also social narratives.
Absolutely.
Robin, this might be a long question, but in your manuscripts, you talk about the desire to have children, that it satisfies some biological urge, some generative thing inside us. But also at the other end, at the end of life, are men driven by... I guess it's the answer is probably both. Are men driven by a desire to satisfy their urge to have children immediately, or is there something about wanting to be cared for in old age?
Okay, I'm going to deal with the cared for in old age. A lot of parents would say, I didn't have children, so I could be cared for in old age. Some parents would, but a lot wouldn't. Again, there's a cultural difference there across different cultures around the world. But let's just sort of say Western for the moment.
Right.
Let's cover a bit of that. Okay. However, structurally, the state will expect your children to do something for you. And that may be just negotiating, being the buffer between the formal services, the formal structures, right, and the but also within your family, you, as an adult child, you may want to do something for your parent. You may want to have your parent in your home, you may not. Families are funny, some are brilliant, they change over time, mm-hmm, and there's a lot of things in there. So put that caveat in about families. But it's really sort of interesting in who's responsible for signing, let's say, if you have to have an operation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Who do they go to first? It's blood relatives.
Right.
It's number one, isn't it? So a biological link. So that's embedded in structure again. So although as a parent, you may not want your adult child to be involved with your care, at some point it's probably going to happen.
Right.
Whether mm-hmm. you do or not. And if you don't want your adult child to be involved in your care in later life, what are you doing about it now?
Right.
Because you should be making plans and making that clear. Because
right.
they may be dragged into it. And it's very complex now. People live all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you could have 6 children, but really be aging without children, mm-hmm. because states is a very big country. They could be the other side of the states. They could be in other countries. There's disruption to the family dynamic. They you don't like them, they don't like you. Things happen. So, although you have children, when you're older, it could be, in effect, you're aging without children.
Well, absolutely.
And in cultures that don't have this structure, I'm thinking more primitive cultures. In our country, it would be the Native American cultures that didn't have insurance, that didn't have the safety net. Your only guarantee when you're older is your children.
Yes.
They're going to be the providers.
So in some cultures, it's very much that the older parent will go in with the eldest child.
Right.
And his, generally his wife would be expected then to care for his parents.
Mm.
Right.
Typically, it's the mother that survives. You know,
yeah, that's true.
Yeah. They work, then they die. In the past, it's changing now with the demographics. Men are lasting longer. So there's that to it. But there's a whole dynamic around that area as well. And you said it earlier about, is there a biological drive? I think there is, and there's a sociological drive, and it's embedded within social structures. There's an expectation you're going to be a parent. And there's some negotiation, some narratives there for women, but less for men, I'd say. And I'd also say, around about the age 35 is very important for men. And the little bit of research I've done into that, the indication is that is a crucial time, because they don't want to be old fathers. It also ties in logically as well, because sperm starts to decline in potency slowly at that point.
Right.
Same as the women's fertility. It just doesn't stop in the same way, so it's a longer timeline. But there's something about not being an older dad. So they want to be a dad when the kid's 15, 16, and sort of stepping out into the world so they can sort of monitor the gate that they step through. In the UK, it would be taking your son or your daughter to the pub, playing football with them, first time in the park, that sort of thing, dropping them off at university.
Right, right.
So those sort of gatekeeper key moments, they want to be there for that.
Right.
Also, it means you're in your early 50s and maybe you've got a bit of a chance to jump back on the reproduction roundabout. Maybe.
That's my hope.
No.
But you know, again, it's so interesting that you're talking about this, because the person I was talking to earlier that I mentioned a moment ago, that was one of the things that the husband talked about, was, you know, they were talking about how many children they were going to have, and this isn't an uncommon conversation, how many children they're going to have, and the concern about how old they would be, each of the mother and the father would be, by the time the children, you know, graduated from high school, because that's sort of not the last major, but one of the last major milestones, gates that you're, as you said, you know, after that you have
marriage,
and you have grandkids. Mm-hmm. But yeah, absolutely, that's something that a lot of people seem to think about.
My brother got on that roundabout, Robin.
Right.
He's 60 and he has a 3-year-old and 5-year-old.
Wow. Yeah.
I feel bad for him.
And that's really interesting. Yeah, just looking at your reactions there, because there's something about not only what individuals want, but actually how society sees people, mm-hmm, who are off time.
Right, right.
Because it's sort of off time to be a parent when you're 60.
Mm-hmm.
And there's Rod Stewart and there's the odd famous people.
Yeah.
Sort of,
right.
Oh, well, that's great. But they are very,
very.
And yeah, and there's other reasons that might be happening there. But but they're outliers. They really are, aren't they?
Right.
And societies tend to want conformity.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. There's a certain age when you should be having a child. So having a child at 14, 16, 18, a bit young.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Having a child. Well, the fertility industry would say after 35, but in your 40s.
In your 40s, right.
But becoming a father then as well.
Yeah.
But certainly 50 and afterwards. Actually, you should be a grandparent now.
That's right.
You're off time. And some of the guys said that actually to me, although some of the guys still wanted to be parents and they were 50 and 60 and a little bit older. Some of them said, actually, you know, now this age, it's not appropriate. Who would want, if you're 12, a father who's 62 turning up to the school gate? They'll think you're a grandparent. How appropriate is it? However, another guy said he was 60, he had a younger wife, and they were going for children. And he said, well, you know, I won't be doing the football thing because my body won't be there. But what I can do is I can provide financially.
Right.
I can provide in other ways from that. I'm sorry, I'm just going to have to let the dog out now.
Okay.
He's interesting though.
Fantastic. So sorry about that.
It's all right. It's all right. Hey, when you got to go, you got to go.
Hey, Rob, quick question.
Yeah.
What is the, you used the term patriarchal dividend.
Yeah. I did, didn't I?
Yeah.
Do you remember? Well, why did I do that?
You can skip any of these questions, Rob.
It's a good question. It's a good question. Well, patriarchal dividend, from the feminist point of view, well, we live in a patriarchy. Men rule most things,
mm-hmm.
Structurally, anyway. I think some men think, actually, on the local level, they don't run things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what men's rights groups would say. Actually, patriarchy's not doing us any favours.
Right.
But there is a patriarchal dividend in structural terms of men get paid more, have better pensions,
right?
That sort of, and tend to have positions of power. Men occupy positions of power within structures. That's a sort of patriarchal dividend. And there's also a dividend, or has been, for married men in their wives or men with partners. Their partners tend to look after them.
Mm-hmm.
So they'll say, go to the doctor, you're not well, sort of thing. And that's sort of proved in the stats. So married men tend to live longer and be healthier than men who aren't.
Ah, okay.
So that's the sort of patriarchal...
That's a little bit different.
Dividend. But it's a relational dividend as well. So being in a relationship. And I guess with the LGBT, that community is well researched now, so that might be coming through in there. Although I think for older LGBT people, there's a fear about being isolated mm-hmm. from the community.
Right.
And then also if you split up from your partner, what happens then?
Yeah,
I think there's some evidence that LGBT people who are older are more prone to negative effects of health, socially, economically, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Hey, Robin, now that you mentioned this LGBT, you used the term non-heterosexual. I like that term, but I've never seen it before. Is that common parlance in the UK?
I think it is in sociology.
Yeah, I've not seen it. I really like it because it's there's no emotional baggage connected to it.
Yeah, the semantics around gender and sexuality is very fluid
mm-hmm.
and all changing. And I'm sure some people hearing non-heterosexuality will be going, hang on, that's labelling somebody or not appreciating the diversity among the non-heterosexual population.
Right.
That's the way we develop. We knock things back and forward and people chip in, and that's how we move on from just being male and female.
Right.
In gender and orientations and stuff like that. But yeah, it's very... I think in sociology and possibly knocking into psychology now research, you get non-heterosexuality in that. And certainly we get heteronormativity would be there as well.
Right.
So this is very heteronormative. It's not including a group of the population.
Right. Now, Kind of thinking about something that we talked about earlier, but it's just something that keeps coming to my mind, especially when I was reading some of your work. You know, a lot of you were talking about the broodiness when you were in your 30s, and you know, in your writing, you talk about involuntarily childless men. Is there a difference between? I guess I really want to know, sort of describe a little bit about what you mean by involuntarily childless men, but also, is there a difference between involuntarily childless men and voluntarily childless men?
Okay. Involuntary childlessness is a term that comes out of infertility, the arena of infertility research and industry. And what happens is you're trying for a child, nothing happens, you go to the doctor and they say, okay, well, let's investigate. And at that point, you could actually say you're involuntary childless because you're trying for a child. You could say that. And then you have some treatments, and maybe the treatments don't work, or because they're very stressful and invasive, the treatments.
Sure. Yeah.
And they really affect people on many, many levels, socially, economically, psychologically, physically, medically. Any arena you care to name, infertility treatment will affect it. And so you end your infertility treatment and it's unsuccessful. Then you'll be labelled as involuntary childless. Specifically in research and in the infertility counselling.
Right.
And there's an organisation in the UK called the Infertility Network, and they've got a group called More to Life, and this is for people who are involuntary childless. So it's where you've ended treatment or treatment hasn't worked, and so you're labelled that. It's not a medical term, it's just a term that is applied to a group.
Sure, sure.
It's quite a cold term. A lot of psychology studies on people actually end after 3 years post-treatment. And what they tend to say, it's a bit on the bereavement scale, you know.
That makes sense.
You come to a negotiation and you accept that you're not going to become a parent, and that's it. But actually, in some of my research, what I found was, it moves in and out. It's actually a bit of a social death, because there's no social narrative about that. Really? Mm-hmm. What do you say when somebody says, oh, well, we tried for children and it didn't work? There is a bereavement, and there's no convenient narrative to go say, oh, well, I'm sorry about that, or da da da. You might go in the UK, well, the weather's terrible, isn't it?
Right.
That would be our default. Okay. So some of the guys were saying, particularly what I'm thinking of, him and his partner tried for children when he was in early 40s, she was mid-30s, tried IVF, didn't work, and then went through a process, a counselling process, where there was a ritual bereavement, and they went through that process, and that was fine, and they moved on with their lives. And then he gets to 60, and he says, you know, I'm walking through the park, I see people playing with children, I think, I'm missing that. Mm-hmm. That's something that's missing for me. And this is what all the chaps say, there's something missing.
Wow. Right, right.
And then their peers, so for me, for example, when I'm 35, my peers are having children, I'm not having children.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and there's a split then. We're mm-hmm. on different tracks.
Right.
Their children take over their lives, not surprisingly. So I'm sort of left as a single man, doing single man things, but actually I don't quite fit in there because I'm an older single man with these younger people. It's a bit odd, so I'm not, when I get married, I'm doing this with my hands. So my peers are on this track here, and their children age and go to university, and we come up and we meet together again at that point when their children are going to university and moving out the house. And then their children develop relationships and have children. So my peers become grandparents, and it splits off again.
Right.
There's an attack of them coming and going away. And so they become grandparents, and I'm not a grandparent. and their lives become full of a narrative around being a grandparent. And sometimes, you know, some people want to be grandparents, other people don't want to be grandparents. Grandparents do an awful lot of day-to-day care. There's amazing stats from America about how much money grandparents save in childcare.
Right, yeah. Right.
For everybody. But for, if you haven't got grandchildren, where are you? So there's that separation again, that difference. And there's something missing. Also, as you get older, I think particularly for men, we're seen more as a threat. There's a thing about men being paedophiles.
Right.
All the men mention that, that this fear of being seen a paedophile.
Right.
So a friend of mine who is a mother, her father was going to visit him, walked across a playground or something, and some kids were playing football. So he had a game of football with them. And came and saw you a bit late, saw you had a knockabout with the lads in the park. What were you doing that for?
Mm-hmm. Right.
You can't be doing that.
Right. That's interesting.
It's quite natural for you want to play football or something like that with some kids.
Right. But that's really interesting. That's it.
I lost this get here.
Did we lose you?
No.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's really fascinating because I think you're right. Mm-hmm. Because people begin to make assumptions,
right,
about those who are seen as, I guess I'll use the air quotes of not typical. Mm-hmm. So if we typically see men of a certain age as parents, and they're not a parent, and then they're out, you know, interacting with kids, you know, here there are those kinds of almost kind of biases and assumptions, you know, when you have a male kindergarten teacher versus a male high school teacher, you know, those are seen as, you know, people ask questions, why are you a kindergarten teacher?
Right.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. Yeah.
Mm, absolutely. And I interviewed a male kindergarten teacher a while back, and he was saying, I'm very careful if a child falls over. I'd always get one of the female teachers to come and sort that child out.
Right, absolutely. I have a...
The natural drive is to pick up a child,
mm-hmm,
that's crying or something like that.
Exactly. I have a... so many examples like jump to my mind because like I have a couple of kindergarten teachers that I work with, and they talk about the, you know, the students coming up and kind of rubbing their back and touching them, you know, because they're just at the right height where they're going to tap them on the backside and things like that. And you think, well, if that happened to a male teacher, you're at risk. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And when earlier in my career, and I know that you did this as well. I worked in pediatrics, and so I worked with children birth to three. And what was always fascinating, or interesting, I suppose you should say, is that, you know, I'd be sitting there talking with parents, and the 2-year-old would come over and like want to sit in my lap or want to interact with me. And you know, you have that concern what are they going to think if I, you know, if I touch this kid, if I put my arm around this kid or put him on my lap or something like that, you know, how is the parent going to respond? How are other people going to respond? I do wonder if, well, I assume that women don't have that same sort of flashbulb of concern.
No, the narrative is very different.
Yeah.
Yeah, you would say the narrative is very different for men and women, right, Robin?
I would say that, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Goffman and his scripts that people perform to, where do they come to? And if you go improv on a script, mm-hmm, how valid is it?
Right.
And it depends where, which social sort of space you're in.
Right.
What you can do. So a lot of men would don't express themselves in emotionally in public spaces too much.
Right.
The exception of possibly football, either soccer or American football, when your team loses. And I always think, when they pan to those shots at the game, when it's been a final, and they're losing it, those men are very emotive.
Right.
And And that is somehow acceptable.
Right, right, you're right.
In that way. But take it out another way, put them in another space, it's not acceptable. Mm-hmm. They did it on the bus or on the train or just walking down the street.
Right.
Yeah, so, so Goffman and his scripts and where you can do that is really interesting. And I think with men, we're sort of conditioned. There's another thing called care by provision. So rather than just being men doing the provider role and masculinity being defined by that, go out, get the food, get the money, provide, come in, but don't occupy an emotional space. It's sort of being sort of renegotiated. Actually, these guys are caring and they're doing it through ways they can care. So if somebody's occupying the emotional space already, what space can you do, unless you want to have a big emotional battle there to find out who's got that? Yeah, so I think that's a sort of softening of that. I think for me, men are conditioned to be virile in all areas outside themselves.
Right.
Economically, socially, emotionally even. So inside, no, I can't do that because, you know, boys don't cry, boys don't hurt. We're a machine,
right?
And we just carry on. We're terminators. we're logical, rational things that just do that. When you know we're emotional, we're a bag of hormones, is what I like to say when I want to upset people. I'm a bag of hormones. I'm just a different bag of hormones from women, and generally, possibly slightly different from men, because we're all a bit unique, aren't we?
Right.
And that bag changes over time.
Mm-hmm.
And our bodies change over time. And we're biopsychosocial beings. And that ratio changes around through age. That's so when we're very young, we're mostly bio.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Psycho's being formed, then social's being formed.
Right.
And as we age, we're social, psycho, bio. And then it sort of spins around again.
Right.
Actually, there's a really little, neat little Venn diagram you could do with that, by spinning around all the time across the life course. I'll give you that for free.
I'll take it.
And I'm sitting here thinking I was thinking of ways to create that. That's a very interesting idea.
You need one of those.
Yeah, Paltoon.
Yeah,
I'm gonna work on making one of that.
Of course, Robin. What about cultures where virility is measured by the number of children you have, and your status is mm-hmm. measured by having as many children as you can?
Yeah, and that's what's really interesting about those cultures is if you're infertile as a man.
Yeah, there would be a stigma.
There would be a stigma. Yeah. And it's really interesting in those cultures, and actually in the Western cultures as well, is that women tend to take the blame for the fertility.
Right. Yes, yeah.
And either that's either a local relationship level, mm-hmm. then they'll take them, or maybe that's embedded in society as well. So if a man doesn't reproduce, then the woman gets castigated, thrown out, chased off, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a professor in America called Marcia Inhorn, and she's done a really interesting book called The New Arab Man, based in Israel, Palestine, Syria, not when the war was going on, about infertility treatments and men accessing infertility treatment. And what she's saying is there's an emergent masculinity, there's a new narrative for those men that they're developing.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I think the biggest infertility clinic in the world is in Abu Dhabi.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm.
Like that. So there's a sort of a myth that the Islamic faith doesn't agree with infertility treatment. But that's changed, mm-hmm. as can be evidenced by that clinic, mm-hmm. and in her book, The New Arab Man, she really goes into that, and she did anthropological research. She went across there, she talked to people, going through treatment and post-treatment. And so she's a wonderful person to read and a leader in the field. Please give me a job, Marcia.
We'll make sure she gets this. Hey, Robin, I'm thinking about, as you're talking, I'm thinking about Henry VIII.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic example of how reproduction is structured in society.
Right.
Mm-hmm. All that kerfuffle, messing around, all because he didn't have an adult boy, an heir.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Of course. Complete fracturing of state and religion. Right. And all down to reproduction.
And all the women had to pay the price.
And all the women had to pay the price. Yeah, absolutely. Brilliant parallel to draw there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, is there a difference, or you may not have researched this, but is there a difference between what we've been talking about with infertility and sort of the involuntary nature of some fatherhood, between that and voluntary? Are there people, are individuals who choose mm-hmm. overtly yeah. not to have children? Is there, do you know of any difference, any particular differences between them and the others?
People who choose not to have children with voluntary channels tend to plan a bit more.
Mm.
So it used to be the reasoning is that people made that decision very early in life and therefore planned for it. But actually it changes across time. So when you're 18, you might say, well, I'm not going to have children. And this would tend to go from the States, research saying most people expect to become parents. 80% of, I think it was 18 to 20-year-olds at a university expected to become parents. And you do big numbers in the States very easily, so that's a good graduate. But then later on in life, you might actually say, no, it's not happening for me. I don't get the biological urge, or my experience as a child wasn't great at parenting for whatever reason, and there's many reasons, and actually I'm not going to do that. What then happens is, what narratives can I occupy here? Because to say, I don't want to have children sort of labelled you as being anti-child,
mm-hmm.
which is not correct.
Right.
You can not want children, but be a teacher or be a paediatrician and like children. You just don't want to have them. Or a medical reason, so there's a thing where your menopause can come very early. Right. 14, 16, something like, you get menopause. So, although it's not voluntary childlessness, you're sort of in that, can be labelled as voluntary childless because you're not having children, unless you explain your medical background.
Yeah.
So what tends to happen is that voluntary childless people either make a statement saying, I'm not having children, I don't like them, it's ecological, whatever. Or they say, oh, well, I'm thinking about it. They sort of hedge it.
Right.
Or they say, oh, I'm going mm-hmm. through infertility. So they do a passing. So like Rosenfield. Dana Rosenfield did a great study based in San Francisco, I think, on what happened after Stonewall and what happened there. And actually before Stonewall, LGBT people passed as heterosexual.
Mm-hmm.
So they are, on the outside, heterosexual lifestyle, conform to that, or lived another life.
Right.
So, occupied the LGBT space under the radar, as such, mostly.
Right.
Stonewall happened, and then lots of things didn't happen. So for voluntary childless, there may be that sort of passing thing, occupying a narrative just to get you through, so you're not, don't have attention drawn to you, where you're stigmatized. And people who don't have children can be stigmatized.
Right.
Like that. So men who occupy jobs that are usually associated with women, so nursing or teaching, or wanting to have be nurturing, can be stigmatized.
Right.
Back and women, and that's been shown in research as well. And people who've gone through infertility treatment say they feel different, feel excluded, and feel stigmatized because of that. So there's an area where voluntary and involuntary childless people share an experience. Yeah. But for voluntary childless people, they tend to plan and they tend to build networks up of other people. So there tends to be a little bit more support in their social networks. And that's important all the way through life for mental and physical health, but also in later life if you've got close friends that you can rely on that are going to take over that buffer role if you need to access health or social care.
Right. Yeah, I think that the maybe a subgroup that I've seen that you're referring to is, you know, people who have, of course, as psychologists, we work with a lot of people with mental health struggles and challenges. And I have certainly seen individuals, men and women, who have decided not to have children because of their mental health issues, and they don't want to, their words are something along the lines of, I wouldn't want to pass this on to somebody else for them to experience what I've had to go through in my life.
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly people who've been abused in their childhood.
Right.
Would say that actually I might be a carrier somehow.
Right. It's almost like a voluntary, involuntary choice.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah, that's fascinating. We have been talking for almost an hour now.
I couldn't
and so
believe it.
We hate to take so much more of your time because
fine, I love the attention.
Well,
we all do. Truth be told.
Well, how can I feel like there's a whole other area of things that I'd like to talk about, but maybe we should even talk about having you on again and talking to you, you know, sort of doing another one to talk some about some of these things. Because, well, we have a whole other group of questions that we wanted to go through to ask you about.
Let's do it again.
Yeah. So how would that sound to you?
Well, lovely.
Okay.
Great. Well, for now then, how could people follow you? What can our listeners, where can our listeners go? Whether it's Twitter or Facebook or a blog or anything, how would it be best for our listeners to follow your work?
Sure. I have a website, which I must get on to do a bit more. It's called wantedtobeadad.com. So all lowercase, all one word. So wantedtobeadad.com. I just realized I said that very quickly. So, or you just Google Robin Hadley, and it should come up with Robin Hadley website. I'm on Twitter at Robin Hadley 1.
Okay.
So that's where I'm around.
Okay. Well, great. Well, we will definitely include those links in the show notes so that folks can follow you and you know, see what work you're doing, and certainly if they have questions for you or they want to interact in any way, that'd be great.
Right.
Yeah, great. Thanks so much. It's been such a joy to talk and shoot the breeze.
All right. For us too. This has been wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for your work and let's do this again.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we've been trying to meet up and talk for a long time, so your patience has been appreciated.
It's so.
So great. Well, so we will definitely talk to you again, and again, if folks want to follow Robin's work, we'll have the links in the show note. So check it out. Okay. All right. Well, until next time, have a great day.
You have a great day too.
All righty. Bye-bye.